you very much. So I'm going to be talking about superluminous supernovae today. These objects are quite rare. They attract much attention. So there's a diversity of superluminous supernovae. The ones I'm going to talk about are primarily some of the ejecta-CSM interaction. These objects can allow you to get access to phases in the evolution of massive stars that you do not have access to otherwise by looking just at stars like, you know, extraordinary events like Eta Carinae, which are very rare. These interacting supernovae are also very rare, but obviously they're very luminous, so you can see them over a huge volume of the universe. And so they allow you to to collect much more information about mass loss in massive stars. Okay, so what I'm going to do is give you some quick overview of supernovae in general, and then tell you about the energetics for supernovae, for standard supernovae. And then once you have that, then you can see what it might take to produce a superluminous supernova, to produce an extraordinary event. So these are the observational evidence for the diversity of supernova displays is illustrated in this plot, which is a light curve, compilation of light curves at absolute magnitudes versus time, which shows the location for objects like Eta Carinae, which are around during the outburst around minus 15. And this spans all the way to minus 22 at peak for this object 2061, which happens to be an interacting supernova. And you can see that you have a whole diversity, both in this direction, in the absolute peak magnitude, and also in the morphology of these light curves. Some of them are extremely broad, and some of them are quite narrow, like this one. Some of them are very bright early on, and some of them brighten at later times. So in this plot, I have a whole bunch. I have both core collapse as well as type 1a supernovae. And so just a quick reminder of the explosion mechanisms for each. Where does the energy come from? If you have a star which is in a hydrostatic equilibrium, how do you break this hydrostatic equilibrium to turn that object into something that is highly luminous and highly energetic? So there are basically, it's the same mechanism in each. You're tapping binding energy. In type 1a supernovae, you tap the binding energy of nuclei. Carbon, oxygen, you turn it into silicon and nickel. If you do this translation or this combustion, for about one solar mass, you release an energy of about 10 to the 51 ergs, which is enough to unbind the object and to produce a very energetic, fast expanding ejecta. So obviously these are coming from low mass stars. So you have another way, which is the gravitational collapse. So here you use the binding energy in gravitational potential, and your object. You collapse your ion white dwarf, which is formed at the end of the life of a massive star, into a neutron star, and you release an energy that is about 10 to the 53 ergs. That's about 100 of what you get in a type 1a supernova. But only a tiny fraction of this energy is actually transferred to the envelope, to the collapsing envelope. And so you get an energy, actually, which is about the same as this. For the core collapse supernovae and type 1a supernova have about the same kinetic energy at infinity. Different ejecta masses, but the same amount of energy. So in this case here, the neutrino energy deposition is absolutely essential. And in contrast to these type 1as, here the combustion is only a feature. It's a secondary agent, certainly for energizing the object. And so the general configuration that you have a very sudden energy release. This goes back to what Stan is interested in right now, about the stability of atmospheres close to the Eddington limit. Here you are in a context where the energy that you deposit over a very tiny volume at the base of your envelope, your stellar envelope, far exceeds the binding energy of the entire envelope. And you deposit it on a timescale that is extremely short. So in type 1a supernova, the burning occurs on a timescale of a second, typically, for a star that has is more than the mass of the sun. And in core collapse supernova, the timescale is also about the same. It's 1 second or less. So the amount of energy released is absolutely gigantic. And so you generate a shock, and that shock goes all the way to the surface. And at the time of shock emergence, which we call a shock breakout, the radiative energy is about the same as the kinetic energy. You get the roughly equipartition. But yes?
Is it really so that the released energy is gigantic compared to the binding energy of the star?
Not gigantic. It's like factor of two. Yeah. What I mean is that is
the envelope.
You exceed the binding energy of the total envelope, but what I'm saying is that the energy that you deposit in over that tiny shell, which may have a mass of 0.1 or something, certainly in core collapse supernova, the amount of energy you dump in that tiny shell is absolutely gigantic. The amount of energy you dump in that tiny shell of 0.1 solar mass exceeds the binding energy of the whole star. But it's true that you don't find
it in pointing out that, as well as in white dwarfs, as in massive stars, a lot of supernovae may fail.
Yes.
So it's not such that you always, you know, have so much energy that you blow things apart.
That's right. But if you take it from the observations, then you only see successes. And and
theoretical consideration.
Well, yeah, but it's this theoretical interpretation of, you know, they're based on what we see. And it's true that you may have, like, 50% of gravitational collapse in massive stars may fail, but we don't have much evidence for that.
So this is sort of the successful supernova.
Well, it's trying to bring an interpretation for what we see. And yeah. And we see supernova every day.
You see the succession.
And, so I would even say that the energy that is released is very similar to the binding energy of the inner
core. It's absolutely right. I may have a...
That's what sets the energy. But it's true that that energy is big compared to the energy envelope. That is true.
I mean, it's a bit like you have this tuning between terminal velocity and escape velocity in stellar winds. Here you have something that is... I don't know exactly what is the tuning parameter, but it's with the explosion energy of the binding energy. You know, it's twice the binding energy. So in an object like 87A, the explosion energy might be 2 10 to the 51 ergs, and then you get an ejector at infinity that has an energy of 10 to the 51 ergs.
Let me just make a quick comment. So part of the way to think about it is that the envelope, as everybody seems to agree, doesn't have a triangle. But of course, you're trying to explode part of the actual core itself. And the point about it there is that if you were to think about what is the escape speed to escape from that radius, it's very, very high.
Yeah.
And you end up with supernovae that have terminal speeds that are comparable to that, so that tells
it's
you...
It's like a thermal ball.
Basically, I'm sorry?
Yeah, it's like a thermal ball.
Yeah, basically I'm trying to say it's where you actually end up, you should succeed, you end up succeeding by factors of order unity, and the speed that you end up with tends to be comparable to the binding energy speed of where you launch them.
For bigger explosions, you'll have more fall.
So in stellar winds, you get V infinity is some factor of order unity times V escape of the surface. In supernova, you get sort of V, you get ejector speeds that are comparable to binding energy of what you actually explode.
But you get something that is, you get a velocity at infinity which is close to the sound speed at the location where you blew up the...
Well, in this case, it might be the same as the sound speed because it's virialized, but in the stellar winds, it's not. It's the escape speed that's
virialized. Anyway, so so after shock emergence, you have this you have you know, only half of the total energy is kinetic, and so you have a lot of energy in the radiation, and so you get a lot of work coming from that, and so the ejector accelerates on the time scale. For red supergiants, it will take, like, most of the acceleration will take less over, like, one day or something like that. But you still have a dynamical phase at 10 days. It takes some time before everything is really frozen. And so when it's frozen, you get a phase which is called Möbius expansion, and then there's no dynamics. The velocity in each mass shell is constant. And so you just have mass conservation that gives you the density at that. So this initial density that you get at the onset of a homologous expansion can be used to determine a density structure at late times just by the ratio of the eta times to the cube. And so you can turn this very complicated problem, at least the initial problem, which is dynamical, into a much simpler problem, which is just an energy problem. So you have this big tank of energy. You know, this is your shocked envelope. And what you want to know is how it's going to evolve with time. And so you have basically some cooling. So you have the initial energy that you deposit. You have the cooling terms, heating terms, and transport of energy. So for the cooling, a fundamental aspect for explosions is that you're disrupting a star, which fundamentally is much smaller than the ejector scale at a week or something like this. And so the amount of cooling you get from expansion is enormous. And so you can go quickly through these equations. Just the first law of thermodynamics, using a radiation-dominated gas. and for adiabatic expansion, and you can throw this in there, and then you get a temperature which basically goes as 1 over R. So it means that if you double the radius, the temperature in a given mass shell is going to drop by a factor of 2. And so you can see the big problem that you have if you start with a white dwarf, because this has the size of a planet, of our planet, 10 to the 8 centimeters, and a typical supernova radius is 10 to the 7 times larger. And so the burning conditions in a white dwarf will put you at a temperature of 10 to the 9, which means that you will drop to a temperature of about 100 Kelvin, which is like room temperature after something like a week or two. And so this is absolutely fundamental for understanding the evolution of this supernova, because if you want to generate luminosity from a supernova, you're going to have to basically release, supply some energy to counteract this effect. And this is a simulation for 87A. This shows the temperature as a function of time. You start with this at 0.3 days, and then you evolve it here to 20 days, and you see the temperature go down. And if you take the radius times the temperature, you should have a constant. And so this is what you see for this black curve here. Initially, you see that for quite some time, a few days, basically they all line up. And there's a region where they never change. And that's the region where you basically have adiabatic expansion. But at large velocity, you have the first curve moving in and leading to radiative losses. And so you actually dip below this curve. And at depth here, you have 56 nickel heating. So you actually get an excess. So, if you inject energy here, you will systematically raise the temperature. And as you cool, from radiative cooling at the surface, you will drop the temperature faster than adiabatic cooling, obviously. And so to counteract this cooling, we have various sources. So as I said, that the one thing that is particularly important, particularly if you have a big star, is the energy that is deposited by the shock initially. So for red supergiants, it's absolutely essential. The amount of energy that you get from recombination is actually not very large. So you get, for your hydrogen, it's 13.6 electron volt for every recombination. So typically, the amount of energy you get by recombining one solar mass of material is of the order of 10 to the 46 ergs. The typical time-integrated luminosity of a supernova is 10 to the 49 ergs. And so recombination energy is basically important at the person level. So it's not particularly critical. Radiative decay is much more important, so particularly for the type 1A supernovae, less important for the core collapse because you produce less. And the reason why is this is so important is because here you're talking about MeVs for each decay instead of electron volts, or 10 electron volts. The second thing which is important is that the typical time scale for this decay is quite long, which means that you're going to release this energy over a long time scale. In particular, you're going to release energy once the ejecta has expanded, so that you can reheat it when this at a phase where basically the cooling you will get from expansion is much reduced. And then you have external sources. So this is basically internal to the ejecta, because this 56 nickel is produced during the explosion, but you can also have external energy sources. So there's one, which is magnetar, or perhaps you could just, magnetar speed down, you could just say this energy injected by the compact remnant. Whatever its properties. So this will inject energy in the inner parts of the ejecta over a time scale that may be quite long, depending on the properties of this magnetar. Or you can inject energy from the outer parts by having the ejecta interact with the circumstellar material or circumstellar medium. Oop. And so if you want to make a superluminous supernova, what you have to do is to vary some of these quantities. So you can increase this, so perhaps by making the radius of the star much, much bigger. So this will tend to translate more of the energy into radiation energy. This you cannot tune very much. This you can obviously increase it by just making the nucleosynthesis much more favorable for the production of 56 nickel. You can use a magnetar that has a lot of energy, a lot of rotational energy when you start with, and it has a magnetic field that is such, it's not too large, not too small, so that you can deliver the energy on a short time scale. Or you can interact with a CSM, so the larger the CSM mass, the larger kinetic energy you're going to extract. And so obviously what you see is that you have many, many ways of changing this, the default properties for an explosion in a vacuum. Yes?
Yeah, but I'm wondering about the effect of the hydrogen recombination.
Yes.
So in the type 2 plateau supernovae, if the hydrogen envelope would not be there, then we would just have a more or less linear decay like in the type 1As, right?
Why is that?
Well, that's what I see from studies who vary the hydrogen mass if you take away the hydrogen.
Well, but it's another effect. I mean, you could take a carbon-oxygen red supergiant, which doesn't exist. You give it a radius of 1,000 solar radii, and you will get a plateau. You get a type one plateau-like Earth. It doesn't exist because these stars don't exist. But the reason why these objects have a plateau-like Earth is because they're enormous. So the amount of energy deposited by the shot is gigantic, and it takes a very long time to release it.
I don't believe that's true. That's
not the standard model.
No, it's not the standard model.
Also, your point that the energy is so much less is also not true, because even though it's a factor of 100 difference, there's easily
more
hydrogen.
Well, how do you mean?
There's 10 solar masses of hydrogen, and there's 0.1 solar mass of nickel.
Yeah.
And then the numbers are comparable. Yeah.
Well, it depends which object you're talking about. It depends on the time scale over which you release the energy and so on.
But just in terms of energetics, it's not a true statement.
I was just wondering why the plateau exists, you know, why is the luminosity kept so high?
That's an effect of the radius. It is not an effect of the composition.
I think
this is just wrong. It's just wrong.
The radius is fixed. The radius is fixed in Eulerian cloud coordinates, and it's true. The temperature is also fixed, and that's fixed because of the recombination.
It's losing the electron scattering or passage. The passing is going down as you combine the electrons, and therefore you can
it's a tuning parameter.
It's not tuning, it's self-tuning.
That's the fundamental effect, as far as I understand.
It's, but it's keeping the radius
constant. Yeah,
exactly. And the temperature is determined by the recombination. So
but this only affects roughly the morphology. For example, you can take a type 1b supernova, could have a plateau. They do have a plateau. If you make the nickel really deep in the ejecta, you can produce a plateau. It's much shorter. There's nothing fundamental about having hydrogen to have a plateau. I mean, what's really fundamental about red supergiant explosions is that they are big. That's the thing. It's not the composition. So I can make a simulation. I just switch. I can make a 15 solar mass carbon oxygen red supergiant. Doesn't exist. And I just blew it up. Yeah, you will have the effect. Your opacity is much lower because the mean atomic weight is much lower. So that doesn't change anything. The thing that is. So the opacity is going to be less, okay? The plateau might be shorter, but you'll get a plateau. It's going to be very bright.
So my understanding is that the combination control the existence of the plateau. But possibly this is not the discussion.
But type 2 linear supernova have hydrogen, they don't have a plateau.
So Popov 1993 gives an explanation for that, right?
1993, which one?
Popov's. So he does an analysis of this recombination rate that the Russians did earlier, right? And his explanation for why some of them are linear and some of them are plateaus is because there are two ways to control where your oxford S is high enough to give you a focus here, right? Either the density drops or the opacity drops. And in the plateaus, it's the opacity dropping versus the recombination, and in the linears, in his argument, it's because the density is dropping faster, right? Because like the explosions faster, be over M's higher, or there's less or more mass.
I mean, this has been studied. There are some papers on type 2 red. They all have hydrogen, and I don't know.
But it's not a sufficient condition to have hydrogen, but the argument is that it's unnecessary.
Of course it's not. I mean, 87A is a hydrogen-rich progenitor, and it has a plateau for like 20 days, and then it brightens.
So it's not the
morphology of this Leica is not. I mean, it's not related fundamentally to recombination. That's not the. For example, so you can see an illustration in there's a paper by Kaysen Woosling 2009, where they get away. They get rid of the. They basically fix the opacity. They prevent hydrogen from recombining. So you get a different light curve. Well, okay, perhaps it has a bit more of a bump or something like that, but it's not fundamentally different. And it doesn't make it much brighter or much fainter. It doesn't, I mean, the light curve is not that different. Now, if you look at this paper by Anderson, in 2014, there's another paper by Sanders, 2015. They compile the Likers for like 100 type 2 supernovae, and you see they're all over the place. You have some plateaus that are very faint, some plateaus that are very bright, you have some linear, you have some short linear, some long linear. They all have hydrogen. So the tuning parameter here is not going to be that the mass fraction for hydrogen is like 50% or is 30%. That seems not true. So that what's fundamental for understanding this diversity, I believe, is the mass of the hydrogen envelope. So it's the E over M for understanding these line curves. But the subject of the talk is interacting supernovae, and so it, you know, perhaps I should move on. So if you want to produce something that is superluminous, what you need to do is to provide more energy to this ejector. So what you can do is produce more 56 nickel. So there are various parts of the planetary space for massive stars where you can do this. You have these supermassive stars, which develop this pair production instability and may produce, in some cases, it's not as systematic, but may produce a lot of nickel. So you might, you know, produce 10, 20, 30 solar mass of 56 nickel, and obviously you make something that is much more luminous than the Taiwanese supernova. Some core collapse supernova might do this as well if they manage to have a density structure that puts a lot of mass at high density. And if you drive a strong shot through these dense layers, you might be able to produce a lot of nickel. But these are both very, very exotic. You can get magnetar radiation. So if your protoneutron star is spinning really fast at the millisecond period, something like that, you can get an energy of the order of 10 to the 52 ergs. And so if you radiate this energy, you can considerably affect the properties of your ejector, so both the dynamics and also its energy content. And then the final one is this interaction, which I'm going to talk about now. So why interacting supernova can be superluminous? So this is an example of the structure that you get for a that's a red supergiant star, which I've blown up. But what I'm showing here is interior mass and mass fraction. So you see the various elements. This is the hydrogen envelope. That's hydrogen, this is helium, and you go into the helium core, CO core, that's carbon, and that's the 56 nickel that you produce at the base. And this is the velocity, the dotted line here. You can see that the velocity in the helium core is very small, and the surface layers are moving really fast. Okay, so in radial space, this would be an homologous expansion, you would have velocity that's proportional to radius. And if you look at the kinetic energy integrated from the surface down in mass all the way to the bottom where you get 100%, what you can see is that about half the total kinetic energy is contained in the outer layers. So, for example, if I was to make this ejector interact with two solar masses of material, I would completely decelerate these regions and I would extract 5, 10 to the 50 ergs. I would extract half the total kinetic energy of this ejector. Now, what you have to realize is that the typical time-integrated bolometric luminosities are the order of 10 to the 49 ergs. So if I tap 1% of this, I can double my radiative display. If I tap 50%, I will multiply it by 50. And so this is very good. Very good engine. The second thing is that this is the region where the density is the lowest. And so if you have a dense CSM, you can really break this material much more than if it was very dense, moving at very large velocity. So let's turn to the observations for interacting supernova. So the cases I'm going to talk about later are these four objects. And here's just one illustration for these for the diversity. So here, all these are type 2 Ns. They characterize as type 2 Ns because they have narrow lines in the spectra. And you can see that, you know, even though they have basically this uniform spectral property, in terms of light curves, you have objects that are extremely luminous. It's 2006 GY. Very different durations. This is 2010 JL that keeps going forever. It was very luminous for an entire year, then it dropped down by one magnitude, two magnitudes. And you have some objects like this guy, 94W, which is nearly as luminous as the type 1A. And you have this 88Z, which went on. I think it might still be going on today, interacting. So what you can see is that you have very different durations for these high brightness phases and different structure in the light curves. And the thing that I'm particularly interested in is the spectral evolution for these different events, or, you know, for the whole class of type 2 Ns. So 2010 JL is, I would say, the school case for interacting supernova, because it matches basically my general understanding of what a supernova ejector should do when it's ramming into a very dense extended CSM, which I will talk about later. So what you get, what I show here is a montage of spectra taken from Franson. It's just the early time properties and the late time properties. So what you see is that you have some, so all these lines have narrow cores. So there's basically a tiny bit of emission that is very, very small in velocity space. And they have broad electron scattering wings. And I will discuss this in the next slide. If you look at H alpha here, you can see the contribution that you have from the CSM. And you can see that these are electron scattering wings. As you can see, as a function of time, the line actually broadens and then becomes more narrow.
What's the resolution there? Is there enough?
So I don't think it's very good. It's like 100 kilometers per second, 50 kilometers per second.
The one at 4.6 one day shows some absorption in H alpha and
now H alpha. Yeah. The H alpha component is an absorption. But so here you can see it. Here too. The other ones, they overlap not very well.
How do you distinguish a genuine emission line from electron scattering wings? So point to these lines and say that's electron scattering wings. How do you see that?
You don't. So I will talk about that next. So what I'm showing here is an illustration of how different the line profile can vary when you change the expansion rate of the region where the spectrum forms. So this is an experimentation that I did back in 2009, trying to model this object 94W, which is a type 2N supernova. And what I started with with this grid line is a typical, it's a bit of a small velocity, but it's a typical H alpha profile. For this case, it's a Piccinni. So it's optically thick, the line is optically thick. You have this strong background radiation from continuum, and you get a Piccinni profile. You can see this absorption in the blue. You have a blue shift of the peak a little bit, and then you have this extended wing. What happens when you take exactly the same model? You don't change anything apart from the velocity. You reduce the velocity, so you go from 1500, 1000, etc., until 150 kilometers per second. You get the black curve. The black curve looks very different. As this peak, there's this absorption here, which is similar to this absorption, but it has very extended wings here, which are associated here with electron scattering. So you can see, even though there's nothing faster in the ejector than 300 kilometers per second or 300 kilometers per second, your line has flux out to 3,000 kilometers per second. And so the reason why you get this is because you basically have two possible, or you have two competing or cumulative effects from electron scattering. So there's one which is non-coherent scattering in the co-moving frame, and it's just related to the thermal motions of the electrons, so you can redistribute. So if you take a plasma at 10,000 degrees, the thermal velocity of these electrons is quite large because they're very light. They move at like 500 kilometers per second. And so you can accumulate a lot of shifts in frequency space by bumping with these electrons multiple times. And so this always operates, and that's basically something that is so non-coherent, and it's set by the thermal velocity. And you also have coherent scattering, which is associated with the bulk motion. So you have you have coherent scattering in the co-moving frame, and because of the bulk expansion of the ejector, you get a shift in frequency space when you go to the observer's frame. And this is systematically a redshift. And so these two processes are basically always present, this effect of the thermal velocity and the bulk expansion velocity of the ejector. And if the expansion velocity is much larger than the thermal velocity, so if it's much in excess of 500 kilometers per second, you're going to be dominated by this redshift effect. So most likely you're going to get a profile that is like this, and the electrons will tend to produce this excess flux in the red. When you go to very low velocities, very slow expansion, like in the wind of Eta Carinae, for example, you're going to be dominated by this non-coherent electron scattering, and you're going to get wings to your line profiles, and the line profiles will tend to be symmetric. So in 2010 JR, this is what you see. At early times, you have a line which is quite narrow. There's about the same amount of flux on the blue side and the red side. And as a function of time, you see that this is no longer the case. There's a shift to the blue, and the line actually gets much broader. And so I will explain this with simulations in the next slide. So what you need to keep in mind here is that you basically have an evolution from a line which has a narrow core and then symmetric wings, and then it tends to broaden at later times with a shift to the blue of the line profiles. That's one evolution. So there's another object that we'll talk about is 98S. So in 2010 JL, the evolution, this characteristic of an interacting supernova, you have clear signatures of an interaction for an entire year. In 98S, the line curve is not shown here, but you can look at the spectra. You see that the presence of these lines, which are symmetric with a narrow core, lasts for about 2 weeks. And then you have this blue spectrum with some weird absorptions. And eventually, you recover a spectrum at later times that looks more like a type 2 plateau supernova. And so the signatures of interaction are much short-lived. I mean, this is showing H-alpha. So you can see that the line is indeed symmetric, and then it sort of disappears, and then it reappears, and it becomes broad. There's a recent paper by Yaron that came out like 1 or 2 months ago, where they show the presence of signatures associated with interaction for an even shorter time. Here you have these narrow line profiles that are there for about 2 days. So this is 6 hours after explosion, the infer time of explosion. By the time of 2 days after explosion, you still have some narrow lines, but there's not much electron scattering wings, you know, compared to this line here. And then you get a blue spectrum with no lines, and then as you go to later times, you get a spectrum that is typical of a type 2 plateau supernova. So what's very interesting here is that these signatures are really, really short-lived. And then there's another object which is very interesting, which is completely conflicting with the evolution that you see in 2010 JR, which is 94W, and actually there's a whole bunch of events that look essentially exact twins, they're identical, in which you have these narrow lines early on, and then the lines keeps narrowing with time. It never broadens. And for this object, it's still, because it has narrow lines, people say it's an interacting supernova. But this is completely in violation of what you expect for an interacting supernova. And we'll discuss that with the simulations later. Okay, so the simulations I'm going to talk about next, they basically explore the various, the results that you get for various combinations of ejecta and CSM. So in the literature, and when people started working on did simulations for supernovae in the 80s and 90s, the general idea is that these ejecta would be quite massive and highly energetic, and there would be the possibility of running into CSM that would be probably less massive. There was always this mismatch that the ejecta would completely overtake this CSM. And in fact, if you want to broaden this perspective, you can consider cases in which the ejecta can be much less massive than the CSM, and you get configurations that are basically results that are really different. So I will talk about these three cases. I'm not going to discuss too much the details of these simulations. What I do is multi-group radiation hydrodynamics. So it can be done in 1D, 2D, 3D. All the simulations I show here are 1D. And it's multi-group, and that's essential if you do interacting supernova, because the radiation temperature can be completely out of equilibrium with the gas temperature. So if you throw Lyman photons onto a cold gas, the opacity is absolutely gigantic. And these Lyman photons will be completely stopped, completely absorbed. If you do a gray calculation, you throw Lyman photons, but you don't really... Because it's gray, you don't actually distinguish. But if the gas is really hot in the region where you emit, this radiation going through a cold gas is going to see a very low opacity. You get this very inaccurate description of the interaction between light and gas if you do a gray calculation. In the context of standard supernovae, you get a radiation temperature and a gas temperature that is quite close. It's in close proximity, and so they're not so much out of equilibrium, and so doing a gray simulation is not a bad thing. In interacting supernova, it's really important to do multi-group. So, yes?
Is there a minimum number of groups you have to have for it to be reasonable?
I think you could probably do these simulations with just two groups.
Okay.
It's not very good, but it captures this fundamental thing that you have a gigantic jump in opacity with the Lyman edge.
You try to go up to many hundreds or
thousands. Well, so the problem with this is that you try to improve the accuracy of the calculation, but then these simulations are done treating the gas in LTE.
Yeah.
So you're putting, you have something that is infinitely accurate on one side and terribly poor.
So at what point is the trade-off for
Well, I think it's what you want to do is to bring the whole calculation in greater physical consistency. So I think there's no point improving so much the number of groups if you're still treating the gas so poorly.
So how many did you use in this
study? So in this one we have 8.
Okay, thank you.
But I think the bulk of the results that I show here would apply if I had 2 only. Because what's really fundamental is the fact that most of the radiation coming from an interaction is going to be very hard. It's going to come at X-rays and UV. And the key thing about these interacting supernova is that the bulk of the radiation is coming out in the optical. And so what you want to see is really see how you go from this high energy radiation that is dumped at the shock and how it comes out, how it leaks out in the optical. Okay. I'm sorry?
You're going to simulate H-alpha, right?
So the way we do these simulations is that we do the radiation hydrodynamics, basically with the standard approach. So we treat the gas in LTE. We let the radiation do whatever it wants. So if it wants to go out of equilibrium with the gas, there's no problem. We have separate equations for we solve the radiative transfer and also the radiation, the hydrodynamic equations, and we have coupling terms between the two. And once we've done this simulation, we have our full evolution for the interaction. Then we do radiative transfer simulations with CMLGen for this. So for configurations that are, so in particular for this study, as long as we have some regions of the grid are in LTE, then the post-processing with CMLGen is actually quite accurate. As soon as the optical depth goes down, we do not recover the luminosity, and that's because the entire grid is out of equilibrium. So there's no place on the grid where you have LTE, even though it's assumed in the radiation hydro. So the simulations for type 1 BNs, for example, are right now impossible with the approach I'm describing here, because it's too low density, so everything is out of equilibrium. So doing LTE when you're not in LTE is potentially dangerous. Really, it really compromises the properties. Okay, so the first simulation I'm going to show is this first space case for 2010 JR. So what I take is an inner shell, 10 solar mass, 10 to the 51 Hertz. That's the typical red supergiant star explosion, blue supergiant star explosion for 87A, and I artificially decide that at 10 to the 15 centimeters, which is that point here, I put this CSM. So this was formed through a strong wind, mass loss rate of 10 to the minus 1 solar mass per year. And I put 3 solar masses of material in there. So this thing extends out to 10 to the 16 centimeters, and it's moving 100 kilometers per second. And so what I do is that I follow this thing. So obviously what you're going to get, you have this homologous expansion here. You have a gigantic shock at this location. And then this, you're going to have a formation of a reverse shock moving in and a forward shock moving out. And because you have very strong radiative cooling, around this discontinuity is going to be very dense. It's going to form a cold dense shell, and that dense shell is going to sweep through the ejector. And so this is the evolution of 300 days that I'm showing here. So this is 4 days. This is very early on. So the shot is here, and you can see. Let me go through all the panels. So this is radius, temperature, velocity, density. That's the opacity, the optical depth here. This is the flux divided by CE. So in regions where you have an isotropic radiation, you get 0. And in the regions that are free streaming, you get 1. That's the luminosity as a function of radius. So that's 4 pi r squared times the local flux. And that's the radiation energy divided, or the internal energy divided by radiation energy. I'm not quite sure, but we can ignore that. So when you start the simulation, what will happen is that a huge amount of energy is going to be released at the level of the shock. And so this radiation is coming out. The different colors here correspond to the different energy groups. So you go from 1 to 8. This is low energy. This is high energy. And so this radiation is crossing the grid on the light travel time. So here what it's doing is that it's heating up the material. So this is the edge of that precursor, if you want, filling up the grid. So as a function of time, this shock is sweeping up the CSM. You can see this is the high density region, so this shock is going to move through. And it's being strongly decelerated. This is at 30 days. Initially, the velocity was 10,000 km per second. like 30 days, there's nothing moving faster than 5,000 kilometers per second. And you have your luminosity, you see that the bulk of the luminosity is indeed injected at the shock, and you have like roughly radiative equilibrium in the outer regions. This plot here shows you the optical depth. The dotted line here gives you the optical depth 2/3. The electron scattering optical depth corresponds to the dashed line. Where it crosses is the photosphere. So what you can see, initially, this is at early times, the photosphere is first progressing out in radius. And you have you inject the energy very deep in the so at the shock, which is very deep in the CSM. And as a function of time, the shock is going to move out, but the photosphere is not going to move, it's going to stay there. So you look at 100 days, 180 days, the photosphere is still there, now the shock is much closer to that thing. So what's happening here is that you're injecting energy at the shock, and the shock is obviously progressing through the CSM. The optical depth of the CSM on top of that shock is going down. And so initially, you expect that you're going to have a lot of reabsorption of this energy emitted at the shock and reprocessing by this slow-moving CSM. And this would be the origin of your electron scattering broadened lines. But as a function of time, the shock is getting much closer, or the dense shell is getting much closer to the outer parts of the CSM. And so you're going to start seeing photons that are not fully reabsorbed. You know, they're not completely absorbed by the CSM. You're going to start seeing photons that have a Doppler imprint, that have basically a large velocity. And this is basically what you expect for a standard ejector. Initially, you should see narrow lines because you have full reprocessing of the radiation that is emitted by the shock. And as a function of time, this would be less and less efficient, and you're going to see broad lines. And so this continues, and this shows the light curve that you get. This is in the log. This is the light curve that so the bolometric luminosity that we record at the outer boundary. So for 10 days, you don't see anything because it takes time for the radiation to get there. It's time dependent. And then you see a very rapid rise. And then you see this bump here, and then it goes down. This location here corresponds to about 300, 400 days, and that's when the shock or the cold dense shell gets out into the CSM of very low density. So as I said, this is the light travel time to the boundary, to the outer boundary, R max over C. This region here, where the green curve here is the energy, roughly approximated value for the energy or the luminosity that is injected at the shock, which is given by this formula, approximately. And at early times, the light curve that you record at the outer boundary is very different from this curve, and that's because the optical depth of the CSM is very large. So basically, you're injecting a lot of energy, but it cannot get out because it's too optically thick. And eventually, so you store energy. And eventually, you're going to overshoot the instantaneous rate at which you inject energy because you will not only have the current supply, instantaneous supply, but also the release of the stored energy. And so you get this bump in the light curve. And then eventually, as the shock moves out and the CSM optical depth is going down, you don't have these optical depth effects. And the two curves agree. Then they actually they are exactly coincident at late times. So if you take a type 1a supernova light curve, there's also the same morphology. Here, the injection of energy is not from a shock, it's from 56 nickel decay, but that's exactly the same. You have a huge amount of energy, it's an exponential decay, so it's going down like that, similarly to this curve, roughly. And so you have a type 1a luminosity that is very small early on, and then you eventually overshoot. You release the stored energy, and then you go into steady state. So this is a typical morphology that you get for an ejector that is optically thick. But then we did the simulations for this configuration with CNFGEN. So we treat the non-monotonicity of the velocity field by doing a Sobolev calculation instead of treating line blanketing and treating all the lines and how they overlap and all this. And by doing this, we can capture the contributions to the spectrum from the regions that are unshocked, basically the cold CSM, as well as the regions that have been shocked, the dense shell, and potentially from the ejector that has not been shocked yet.
You're assuming the CSM density is uniform here?
So what we do, we start with this, okay? We put it into this radiation hydrocode, we evolve it. So we get basically a sequence.
Yeah, but the initial distribution of the CSM.
The previous figure.
Yeah,
that's the density profile that we have. And so we do this simulation. As I said, this outer shell is 10 to the minus 1 for the mass per year.
All right. So I was just wondering whether the slope of the light curve, once it becomes optically thin, can tell you anything about the density profile.
Oh, absolutely. So here, when it goes optically thin, you basically get the instantaneous, basically the radiation that you observe is exactly the radiation that is being injected at that current time. In 2010 JR, the observations follow roughly this red curve here. And it's basically a fundamental feature here is that there's this break. And this break indeed coincides with the time when you have this fall off. So in the observation, this is what we have in the observations, and you make a preconceived idea that indeed this is what happens. So you set up your model so that you will have a break in density at that time. And then indeed this is what you see.
Now, I just wonder if you could maybe infer backwards from the shape of the light curve what the shape
of the light curve should be. So from the shape of the light curve, you know that this means that 10 to the 16 centimeters. Yeah. And you can say that the shock we get there after a year or something like that. Yes. And this object suggests that indeed there are massive, we don't know exactly the mass of the progenitor star, but there are stars that lose mass over a very long time scale. At a gigantic rate, 10 to the minus 1 solar mass per year. And we know this is a weird solution because the light curve is very flat. And this is the observed light curve. It's basically the sustained luminosity that you get is not compatible with an explosion, because in an explosion, you would get density profile that's much steeper. And it's very hard to keep up with this with this luminosity. So
which slope is the one that would tell you about the pre-existing medium? It's the slope before?
Well, everything tells you something about the existing medium.
Yeah.
This bump here tells you that the medium is optically thick. If it was completely optically thin, you'd get the instantaneous decay rate. You'd be following this at all times. You don't, because it's optically thick. You know that it's optically thick as well, because you get these line profiles. The electron scattering optical depth is 10, 20, 30, something like that. And you know that for the luminosity of this object, this CSM has to be at a radius of 10 to the 15 centimeters or something like that. It's gigantic radius. And the only way you can make an optical depth of 10, 20, 30 at this radius is by having a few solar masses. It's, 10 to the 15 centimeters is the scale that is reached by a supernova when it turns optically thin, roughly. So, like 10 solar mass of matter, you will turn optically thin at this radius. So you have to stretch it a lot.
How different would the light curve be if the density was constant?
So if the density was constant, what you'd get here, this thing would be much bigger. So it's 1 over r squared is not far from constant, compared to 1 over r to the 10, if you had a supernova ejector. But if it was constant, you'd get something much, much flatter. You'd get much more luminosity.
Very pretty flat. So.
Well, this is in the log. It's in the it's flat. But 1 over r squared is flat compared to the density profile in an ejector, and this is shown in the log. It's you double your radius, density has gone down by a factor of 4. It's very small.
I'm just wondering, this density exponent in your density distribution, this radius. What's the error bar there based on the light curve?
I don't know. Haven't modified that.
Right. Don't worry.
Could you go back to the first slide?
I mean, but the thing is that there's a feedback here. This is the problem. So the denser the CSM, the stronger the deceleration of the shock. So you're going to have more energy early on, but you will have less energy later on because you will have decelerated this shock much more. So you have to consider all the effects. It's not linear.
So we will also get
lower the density.
Anyway, well, if you lower the density, you're going to get rid of this thing.
It's going to change the shape, yeah.
But could you back to the first slide again, the one that shows the initial model? So you have 1/10 of a solar mass per year,
yes.
A total of 3 solar masses, so
yeah. 30 years.
It's 30 years.
So. Yeah. All right. 30 years, and it fills up this volume, 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 16 centimeters.
So it can't be a sudden ejection.
So this one, I think, is very hard to reconcile with the sudden.
Also, the inner hole, so to speak, because you set it at 10 to the 15 centimeter, that's not the stellar radius, right? So there's some gap between the
So what, if you look at this, this is it's sort of this is an homologously expanding ejecta, which is getting, it's just exploding. It's it could be in a vacuum, and then you get like a normal type 2 plateau supernova, and it's just here, it's running into three solar masses of matter.
How far past breakout are you?
Well, so how long does it take to get to the 10 to the 15th centimeter? It takes 1 week, something like that. So I'm not sure it necessarily makes a big difference. The fundamental difference that you get, which is sometimes not emphasized in these simulations, is that what you have here is that the shock is not radiation dominated. Now, if you put the material at the surface of the star, when the shock gets exceeds the star, it's radiation dominated. You have 50% of the total energy, which is radiation. Now, this radiation is going to affect the behavior of the shock tremendously. Here, it doesn't. There's no, the radiant energy in this region is basically zero. You know, it's you know, compared to the kinetic energy, there's very little. And so you're a totally different configuration. The energy that you get from the light curve is the continuous supply of radiation by the shock. Whereas if you had the shock breaker into the CSM, a lot of the energy that you would get would be the energy that basically leaks out from the from behind the shock, because there's a tremendous reservoir. Here, there's no reservoir of radiation energy in this region. There's nothing.
Should the shock breakout flash have affected the temperature for the ionization state of this material?
Yeah, so I've actually done simulations for this, and what you get is that you would have an ionization wave going through this medium, and then it would recombine partly, and then it would be smacked again. And in fact, there's a paper by Moria about this, because some of these superluminous supernova have observations now prior to the high brightness phase, and they do see basically they see like a normal supernova before seeing the superluminous supernova. And that's most likely, in interacting supernova, the result of that thing. So you get, it's not just the shock breakout, it's also the, so if you take a red supergiant explosion, you're going to have a continuous supply of energy, you know, from the photosphere, you know, up to the time when you get interaction. And then once you start interacting, the luminosity is going to go up by a factor of 10 or 100.
So just to get this right, then, so what we need to explain this is a superwind, which lasts for some time, but which stops shortly before the supernova explodes.
So, well, first, so I don't know whether this is a terminal explosion.
Before the supernova starts.
Well, before the second ejection. Basically, if you want to have an interaction, you need to make sure that the outer shell, at first, is slower than the inner shell, and it's not too far. Yeah, there is a subtle chronology, you know, to these events. It has to be timed.
But that's a strange thing to have, right? That before
the
you get the supernova go off, you have no wind.
Yeah. Do you really need a gap?
Most that's people want the opposite.
Well, so basically, it doesn't make any difference if you take, or it makes less the difference is not necessarily very large. If you extend this high-density region to deeper, you know, closer to the photosphere, it's not necessarily very critical. There's this issue with the behavior of the shock, whether it's radiation-dominated or it's not radiation-dominated. This will have an implication.
You just said that some observations where you first see normal.
Yeah, some.
Only later on you turn on the supernova.
Yes,
yeah, but the observations are huge biases. So 2006 GY, I don't know what is the first data point on the light curve. 2006 GY, when you see the first data point, it's already going to maximum, and there's actually no observation for the phase when it was quite faint. It's already superluminous at the first data point. Most objects have no record of their previous history. It's too faint. They're superluminous, but you can see them very far, so you see them because you can probe a large volume of the universe. But anything that happens, you know, in that event that has a typical supernova luminosity, most likely you will not be able to see it because it's just beyond the limiting magnitude for the.
But in the case where you do see it.
So when you do see it, then you have constraints. Then you can say what happens. What is the delay between the explosion and between the first ejection and the second ejection? So the point here is that at this speed, it takes something like a decade for that material to get there. And it takes just a few days for the explosion to get there. So it's you know, from the point of view of the timing for the supernova ejecta, you know, whether the CSM is here or it's here, it makes no difference. It's moving so fast. Obviously, for the CSM, it's very relevant.
Luke, those masses, are they derived from the light curve or the spectrum? These electron scattering things, and you were.
So I would say that they're independently. I would say independently derived. I think you can get these numbers by looking at the spectra and by looking at the light curve separately.
And you get the same answer?
Yeah. In the sense that if you want to get the electron scattering wings, you're going to have something optically thick, you know, optical depth then or something like that. You know the radius from the, you know, you look at the luminosity, not even just the evolution, you know that this thing is gigantic and it's not particularly hot. It's very luminous because it's very big. And so, you know,
what
the mass is.
The point comes from spectrum.
No, as I say, you can get. You can get. It comes from this, and it comes from fitting the spectra.
The progression of the light, of the profiles.
I would say even, the progression of the profiles, what this tells you is that you basically have this contribution from electron scattering over a length of time. So you know that there's a huge supply of material to make electrons, you know, affect the spectra over like 1 year. This is really an exceptional event. And then from the luminosity point of view, the object is really luminous for an entire year. So the same thing, you need to constantly supply energy over that time scale. And
so the three solar masses comes from the evolution of the spectrum. And the 0.1 solar mass per year comes from the strain of the light.
I didn't try to come up with a simplified model that would have I keep one parameter constant and I vary others or things. Basically just went into the steps of Franson, who just used primarily used the light curve to constrain the properties of the CSM, and I looked at did spectral calculations to see whether this was confirmed and what you can learn from it.
How much are you limited by the spherical assumption, because energy will likely stay in the region where the shell is less dense.
Yeah. So the thing is that if you have line profiles. So here, the lines are very broad, but the point is that there are some people who argue that you can get type 2 ends by having an ejecta running into a disk, for example. And this model is not viable. But this is the extreme, and it gets the point. Basically, what it means is that if you decelerate the ejecta over a very small solid angle, you will not get the narrow lines. You're going to be completely swamped by the broad lines. Yeah, you can make the morphology of the CSM quite asymmetric to basically complexify the thing. And perhaps indeed you have some asymmetry. For example, 2010 JR, there's polarization signatures at 30 days that are seen. And it's clear that it's asymmetric. But the point is, the reason why these things are very powerful is because you decelerate the ejecta over all angles. If you start reducing or interacting with the ejecta over very few angles, over a small solid angle, then you're going to reduce the efficiency of your engine.
I agree with that. My question is, since you cannot expect to have a full sphere.
Why not? I don't know. they can be asymmetric, but a little bit. Yeah, so this will change the propagation. So if you do 1D, your shot is obviously going in all directions at the same speed. And if you start having a different resistance of this CSM, your shot will move at larger velocity, but it will produce less luminosity, and so you're going to have multidimensional effects that will affect this. So I've done some simulations for this with a postdoc Vlasis, so we explore these things, the implications on the light curves, and you can basically vary a great deal the subtle aspects of your light curve, but you don't change anything to the basic.
So I guess one question might be, what fraction decrease from 4 pi steradians could you tolerate and reproduce?
Well, it's like an exercise. You need narrows. You need electron scattering to really impact the line profile. So you don't want to have the ejecta not decelerated. Right. So I don't know, perhaps you can play around with a few tens of percent. So what you lose by not decelerating a full ejecta, you can compensate by increasing the energy of the ejecta, you know, the kinetic energy, or increasing the amount of material that you have in those regions where there is interaction. But this is like
that would affect the light curve. It would affect the spectral line shape.
Well, it will affect the spectra because these regions that are not decelerated, they're going to be Doppler broadened. These photons will have a strong Doppler imprint, you know. And
sure. Okay. And then the width of those broadened.
And from a disk, it's impossible because a disk, even if you take a thick disk, the solid angle is way too small. It's not going to.
But it's also not expanded. You don't ever get the.
So
the blue shift effect. You don't ever get the asymmetry effect.
Which asymmetry?
The one that you talked about, there are two effects to get the electron scattering. You get the thermal effect and then you get the expansion effect. Right?
Yeah, but so the expansion effect is really dominating when you have explosion in the vacuum.
Yeah.
Once you start interacting, then you have this complex morphology that electron scattering contributes and Doppler broadening contributes, and you have optical depth effects that contribute. And I could go on with this. There's lots of subtle issues.
I have another question.
Yes. Yeah, I have many more slides because there are three more cases I wanted to cover.
Oh my gosh.
It is a discussion, though.
Yes.
So, in principle, if you have this shock going through the shell, the outer shell, and in the limit that you have a sharp edge of this and just empty space after that, you would have. Ordinary kind of supernova shock breakout phase when the shock reaches the edge of this shell, right?
Well, not shock breakout, no. So in the simulations, the event is really slowly progressing. You can see, so in those simulations, so your shock is here, your photosphere is that point. So your photosphere is somewhere there. And in fact, you have this. People doing laboratory experiments for radiative shocks, they can change to they shock they have some material in the tube, they shock it at the base and they can get a shock going through, and depending on the density in the medium, they can get a little precursor moving ahead of the shock, and you can tune if the density is really uniform, you can get the precursor to be, I don't know, like a tenth, be some fixed length if it's uniform density. So you have your shock moving, and there's always a tiny precursor moving ahead of it. So this means that there's a bit of flux going ahead, but the photons can't diffuse out very far because the shock is moving. You reduce the density, or you make the density go down, like in a star, what you get is that initially there's no precursor, and then when you go into the density regions that are quite low, then this precursor is going to lengthen, and you're going to have an infinite precursor. This is an infinite precursor. So optical depth 2/3, this is the luminosity, that's the location of the shock. And optical depth 2/3 is somewhere here. But there's no jump in luminosity between this region and the photosphere.
I was more thinking about temperature than luminosity, because if your shock is buried by the whole shell still, then the highest shock temperature is mediated by the fusion through the shell. When the shock reaches, gets closer to the edge of the shell, I thought maybe you would see some kinking of temperature.
So the hardness can change, but here we don't see that when we do the spectral calculations.
Like in the model of Franzen, there was some hint of it, perhaps.
You can see that this stuff, this is early times, and this is late times, it's just cooling and cooling, and the shock is getting weaker and weaker.
Model by Franzen at 176 days, it looks like the spectrum is a bit harder than before.
Yes, we've done rad hydro calculations of this where the shock goes through, and because of that, you can get some higher temperatures. You can extend things like you can get X-ray even at later times.
Yeah, but you're not going to get X-rays here. Yeah, the density is enormous.
Depends on the densities that you have, so you can put different connections. So there's, there are some supernova where the X-rays lasted a long time, and one way was to do that shock eating and then let it.
Yeah. I'm wondering whether there could be a signature of,
So definitely these precursors, the precursors are brightest, the wavelength dependent. You should have the higher energy photons leaking out first. I don't know if you see that. Because usually the optical, at least for us, in the laboratory experiments as well. It's all.
I mean, it depends on the opacities. I mean, here the CSM is quite cold, and the Lyman optical depth is enormous.
Okay.
So, I mean, basically, what you see first are the optical photons.
If you're really, really dense, you're not going to get it that hot.
But the point is that these are superluminous supernova. You want high density. If you have low density, they will never be superluminous. You get plenty of X-rays, but the luminosity will not be there. And so and the direct proof of this is that the bulk of the luminosity is coming out in optical. And so, you know, it's injected here and it's coming out here. And the only way you can do that is indeed if the density is large. So this whole thing, you know, fits together. It's not...
Could you just, before you move on, could you just tell us, is there anything known about the precursor? Is there anything known about the precursor of this supernova?
Well, it depends what you mean by the precursor. So so in this one, the light curve, I think the first data point is around time of maximum. So you're basically looking at a phase where this stuff is already, it's like in quasi steady state.
No pre-explosion, I think he means.
There's nothing known about the star that exploded.
When the progenitor.
Yeah, so in some cases, so in some cases, like in so there's, I mean, some people have seen some of these objects having a like a pre-outburst evolution. For some likers, they do see the explosion or whatever is causing this first, you know, this inner ejection running into this outer shell. So they see it before it interacts. There's very little.
In this particular case, which is
2010 JR, 50 megaparsec. I think there's no constraint on what happened 10 years ago. And this is so observationally, this is going to change because many of the surveys that we have now, they've been running for 10 years. And so for many of these events, this would be very relevant for 2Ns because we have a big time span. The regions where we're going to see a superluminous 2N, we will also have a photometry, you know, from 10 years before or 20 years before. So this. This will change in the future.
Would you be able to see the original outburst that produced the wind? They're rare enough that you have to look in a large volume, so you only see them far away. So you only see it when it hits.
Well, you know, Itacarina is -14. You know, it's not very luminous. These guys, we find them because they're at -20, and so if you have something really faint 10 years before. LSST will probably be able to see that, especially if it's a long time scale. LSST will have plenty of time to do like multiple observations, and so you can see the full variability. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So just to connect the spectral evolution with the numerical with the radiation hydrodynamics simulations, this is the evolution for H alpha. So this is the observation, this is the model that you've just seen in the previous slide. And what you can see is that at early times, you get these symmetric profiles, and then they broaden with time, and they shift to the blue. And this is what you see in this model. And so early on, what you have is that the shock is deep. The energy from the shock is being reprocessed by the CSM, and the broadening mechanism is electron scattering. And so you get these symmetric wings. There's a very sharp absorption here, which is a tiny P-signy profile associated with just the CSM, the unshocked CSM, which is moving at 100 kilometers per second. And as time goes on, you have the formation of this very very strong emission in the blue of the blue world of Lyman Center, and which is also seen. There's a different morphology between the two. So what's happening here is that the swept up mass from the shock, this is a swept up shell, is moving at 4,000, 5,000 kilometers per second. It's optically thick. You can't see the backside. It's moving primarily, so it's moving in all directions, but the contribution to you is basically moving towards you. And because it's optically thick, you don't see the red component or the red, or like the emission from the side lobes. And so you get primarily emission from the blue side. And this is still influenced by electron scattering, but the primary mechanism for broadening here is Doppler broadening. So what you're looking at late times in 2010 JL is the dense shell. You have a highly energetic explosion, and eventually overruns the CSM, and so you just see this swept up mass, which is moving very fast, and gives rise to these very broad profiles.
Just a comment, Brian Sten asked, is there anything known about the progenitor? And photometrically, clearly not. but the fact that you have this CSM moving at 100
meters
per second,
yeah,
that means you have the information.
I understand that. But then I want to make that. I need to know what kind of star is trying to do that.
And it looks like an LB Vita star.
It does.
That 100 kilometers. That's actually why
it's lost on me.
The LB Vitas are an exposure.
The mass loss rate that you would get for energy limited mass loss, which is what happens in a supernova outflow.
Here we use 100 kilometers per second, could have been 500. I mean, the ejecta is moving so fast, it doesn't really matter. You don't have a very strong constraint. So well, the observational constraint is to fit this, the width of that line here. I think it's about 100 kilometers per second.
The amount of masses there is the key.
Yeah.
So it could be zero as well.
I'm sorry?
Could it be zero as well?
I mean, from the point of view of the interaction, yeah, it can be zero. Then the implication for the amount of mass you have there, because, you know, filling up between 10 to the 15 centimeters and 10 to the 16 centimeters at 10 kilometers per second, it takes 10 times more time than at 100 kilometers per second. So the implication for the you know, how long it takes to make that shell, I know it's very easy.
But it's not constrained by the spectrum.
The density.
I don't understand that yet, because I understand that you get the inner edge of the shell from when the light curve turns on. But if you say you have your density profile, what happens with your light curve if you just compress the density profile by a factor of 100?
Well, the length scale is going to be completely wrong.
But the shock will decelerate very much stronger.
Yeah, but what we want that thing to last for, this thing is very bright.
Yeah, but
this is like 400 days.
Sure.
So you don't want to make this very compact. This is going to change the optical depth. This will be different. There are many things that will be different.
I don't understand yet how that would be different. I mean, I'm not sure. I understand why the time scale of the high luminosity peak would become very much smaller, because it would still take.
Sure, you can do that. It's going to be very different. There's no doubt. The optical depth of your material is going to be different.
How the difference is going to be?
So what's going to happen? All right, so you're going to get much faster deceleration. That CSM, which is very compact, you're going to dump all that energy into this lump of material, and then it's going to release that thing on a diffusion timescale. Your optical depth is larger, you might get something that will be brighter, and it will fall down faster.
Diffusion timescale is not that dependent on the.
It depends on the optical depth, and if you shrink your material, it's going to be more optically thick.
It will be somewhat, but it depends mostly on the mass, right?
Yeah.
That's the same.
Yeah.
Okay. Just,
I hope you should have the best example.
The results that you have and the models you have, you know, what we're asking for, I think, is basically, you know, some kind of semi-analytic scaling relations that tell you if you change this parameter, this is what happens.
Yeah.
With the numerical simulations, you have lots
for
of
sure.
You know, but I think I completely agree with you. The time scale is set by the certain length you have to go through for the shock to go through there. But you know, the kind of questions that Norbert's asking are quite reasonable. It's just nice now to kind of try to figure out how those things scale in order to
clear experiments.
Well, I'm saying do the experiment, but then also do analytic scaling arguments or how they scale. But let's try to find out about the other cases.
So the key point that you have to take from this is that if you take a normal energetic ejecta running into even a dense CSM, initially you see narrow lines and then you see broad lines. Okay, and then you will see a counterexample 94W, which completely violates this. At a later time, I will show you. Okay, so we did lots of simulations to see. This is why I don't really explore. Sure, you can get scalings and you can explore this in great detail. Essentially, you do whatever you want. You can vary. This is a set of explorations. So the model X I've just shown is this one. So you can increase the amount of energy you have in the inner shell. You can increase the amount of mass you have in the outer shell, in the CSM. And you can try different types of combinations, of pairings. And so you can increase the amount of your peak magnitude by a tremendous amount. You can change the length scale. You can do all sorts of things. And so these models that I show here, and it's a 2015 paper that we had, you can change the kinetic energy over a range. and then so the mass of the CSM, here we go up to 30 solar masses. Obviously, you can change the conversion efficiency tremendously if you increase the amount of mass that the ejecta runs into. You can go up, in this set of simulation, you can go up to 30%, 70%. Okay, so now 98S is something that is a little bit similar to 2010 JL, but the amount of CSM that you have is much smaller. And the reason why it's much smaller is because the duration of this interaction is much shorter. So here, the signatures of the narrow lines, it's less than 2 weeks. And then you go into this very weird profile, and then you go into normal type 2 plateau supernova spectral morphology. And this is the light curve. It looks very linear. So this is basically 100 days that you have. So this is the observed magnitude, but the peak magnitude for this one is like minus 19 or something like that. So we did some simulations for this, and it's basically the same simulation as before. It's the same mass loss rate, but now it's much smaller in extent. So we don't increase the density at a given radius, we just change the extent. So it's a smaller total mass. So we do the same thing, so it's the same set of plots as before. So you have your shock, and you have your luminous thinning of the grid. You have your photosphere, which is this time much deeper in, much closer in. And so for some time, this is at 20 days, the shock is still well below the photosphere. And so the time scale for overtaking this the optically thick CSM is much smaller. So you can see 40 days, it's still optically thick, and then it eventually goes into this low density material. And 80 days is completely over. And so the thing is that if you look at this density structure here, the photosphere is going to be, so it's actually at this location. So it's within the dense shell. And I didn't put the next one. But eventually, as the material expands, the spectrum is going to form deeper into the inner regions. And so you have the potential for seeing both the contribution from the dense shell as well as the inner ejecta if the interaction takes a shorter time. And so this is the numerical simulation that we did for this one. So this is the observation that you've already seen, and this is the evolution that we have when we can post-process these numerical simulations for radiation hydro with radiative transfer. And so we get this typical profile, narrow line cores and broad wings, and eventually you get a featureless spectrum, very blue, with a tiny bit of emission around H-alpha and so on. And then eventually you overrun this CSM, and the spectrum forms both in the cold dense shell, which contributes this H-alpha line, as well as the inner ejecta, where you get all this extra absorption. And so there's a correspondence between the two, which is more evident when you look at H-alpha. This is the observations, and this is the model. And the whole point of this modeling is to try to understand how you can reproduce this evolution, which is quite spectacular. And indeed, this configuration and the modeling does well. But you get these electron scattering wings initially, and then you get this very weird profile here. There's a tiny bit that comes from the unshot CSM. And then you get this blue-shifted absorption, which is similar to what people were talking about yesterday when you have these Wolf-Rayet stars that have the sort of transition between O stars and Wolf-Rayet stars. You have a weak mass loss rate or low mass loss rate. And so the first signature that you get when you go from no mass loss rate to a little bit of mass loss rate is that the absorptions, your absorption lines, which are centered at the rest wavelength of each line, start shifting to the blue. And this is similar here. And this is basically the profile that you get because there's no emission associated with the location of your photosphere, which is in the cold dense shell, and is basically in a region where the density drops very sharply, like a photosphere. But you get a blue-shifted absorption. And as a function of time, the photosphere keeps receding, and you start seeing the Doppler-Rodin line profile. And there's no absorption, very little absorption, because it's completely filled in by the contribution from the dense shell, which is moving at the largest velocity in the ejecta. Okay, and then there's this
before you yes. Just ask a quick question. So you said you used the same mass loss rate, but for a shorter time?
Yeah.
What was that again?
It's 10 to the minus 1 solar mass per year.
For how long now?
So it's 10 times less, 3 years.
It's 3 years instead of 30.
And you know that this thing is, this object is like a hybrid. It shows 2N signatures early on, it's clearly interacting, and then there's no longer any sign of interaction, and so it has overrun CSM. Whereas in 2010JR, for like an entire year, it's running through the CSM, and you can clearly see the imprint of the CSM on the line profiles. That corroborates what you get from the light curve. So here, what you get is there's a contribution to the luminosity that comes from interacting. So it's basically deceleration of the ejecta, and then there's also stored energy. It might very well be a red supergiant star that run into some CSM. There's a lot of stored energy in a red supergiant star that you shock. Without the CSM, this object could have been a type 2 plateau supernova. And so you get a boost to the luminosity at early times that makes the light curve look more linear.
Why do you keep talking about red supergiants? The wind velocity is an astronomical second.
So in this one, I don't know whether it's... there are several problems. I'm not sure the observations tell you very accurately the velocity of this material in many cases.
The progenitor winds, you can measure it from the narrow peak signal.
Yeah, if you have the resolution.
There are high resolution data.
Yeah, but I'm not sure for 98S.
Yeah, for 98S.
Okay. So yeah, if you have that, then you can constrain it. Sure, you can constrain it. But from the point of view of my work here, I don't care whether it's moving at 10 kilometers per second or 100 kilometers per second. This is
what kind of velocities would you expect?
About 100.
The second thing that you have to be very careful is that at the phase of shock breakout, the radiation from the shock is going to accelerate the material. And so for a few days, the width that you will see will not be the original velocity of the material. It will be the velocity that has been modified by shock breakout. And so these things are potentially completely in error. People have to be very careful with these measurements.
Have you calculated that acceleration?
Yeah. Well, you can see it in the simulations. So if you look at 2010 JR, it's quite a bit of acceleration going through the spectra. It takes time. I'm not sure we can see it very well. But you can see it's raising. Velocity is going up. It's easy to double the velocity in these inner regions. So if you have absorption associated with that, then you're in trouble. If the bulk of the narrow line is forming from these external regions, then you're okay. The second thing is that when I take this structure, I don't change the velocity. This region has the same velocity as this region. What's the temperature here? Velocity. If I put everything at 100, it may be that this thing is moving faster or it's moving slower. I don't know. So.
Can I ask a question? Also to understand things better. So can you show the initial setup again? So the
which one? This one?
Yeah. So the temperature of your outer shell is first below hydrogen ionization, is that right?
Yeah, I put it very low.
And which fraction of this shell is ionized at which time? So.
Well, everything gets ionized. In 2010 JR, the amount of radiation that flies through this material is so large that over a time scale, three light travel times, you will have completely heated that material. So you're going to go to like 10,000 degrees. I mean, it depends. And this most likely is not accurate. We're doing LTE. And this, at low density, the plasma will cool through, forbidden lines and things like that. We don't have that.
So
well, no one does.
Up on a very short time,
yeah.
But the photosphere remains.
Absolutely. Why should it move? So you have your CSM. So the hydrogen is going to get ionized, and the location of the photosphere will be set by the density, and then the shock keeps going. So it's like quasi steady state. Why should the photosphere move out?
Capacity changes. No,
the opacity is already done. Everything it had to do in terms of ionizing, it's like 10,000 degrees, and it's not. Ionizing helium is not going to change very much, and in fact, it doesn't ionize helium. So basically, it's the density profile that will tell you where the photosphere is sitting. So what I mean is that you can vary the amount of the strength of the shock by quite a bit, and the photosphere will not be any different because you supply so much energy that there's no ionization issue.
So in the first case you discussed, it takes a year for the photosphere to go through the shell. But you're saying the shell is nevertheless heated?
It's on the light. It's not, it's like a week. It's a light travel time through the shell that it takes to heat the material.
There are many photons which go through the whole shell very fast. But
it's a bit tricky. So the shock is going to inject the photons in the X-rays and the UV. This is absorbed, and then actually part of the ionization is going to be done by just like thermal collisional heating by low energy photons, because the low energy photons can go through this cold material much more easily, because you know, the opacity is much lower. You're sitting in Balmer continuum or in the Paschen continuum. So you have less energy, but you can travel. Whereas the Lyman continuum photons, they have a lot of energy, but they can't travel. And obviously this changes. The opacity of the medium is different as time goes on, because you dump energy, the temperature rises, the Lyman opacity is going to go down. And so then you have a trade-off. Then the energy, in, you know, the photons at high energy will start being able to move a bit faster. Well, everything is going to be controlled by electron scattering opacity, or in some sense. If you're going to move to that as the configuration is, it looks more like a gray.
But then if you have, so your whole shell ionized very early on, then you will already have very early on also recombinations from the other part of the shell.
But you don't get recombination.
You don't get any recombination.
No. Why should you? Because you have a shot going through there, it's injecting 10 to the 10, it's injecting 10 to the 10 solar luminosity for an entire year. And it's quasi steady state, it's moving along. And you know, if you have a density that's nearly constant, the rate at which you inject energy is basically not going to drop. It's going to go like 1 over R or whatever, 1 over time or something like this. It's basically you have a huge supply of ionizing photons or
but it takes a thermal diffusion time, which is a year, to get that supply out to the outer edge of the shell.
I don't understand why. No, it's a light travel time. It's a week. But because it's quasi steady state, it doesn't matter. You know, the amount of energy that you lose from the outer part of the CSM is about the same as the amount of energy you inject. So it makes no difference. The temperature is going to be like a constant. You supply as much as you lose. So like for an entire year, this thing is a very good it's a very good balance. The temperature should not change that much. The temperature will eventually drop because you're decelerating this you know, ejector, and the shock is weakening, and you know, the luminosity does go down, and then the spectrum starts get reddening anyways.
Let's go on. It's 40
So, but I was talking about this guy. So this is a bit of. What I've been doing here, I'm talking about three cases. The first one is where the outer shell is gigantic, 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 16 centimeters. And then the second case, 90S, was between 10 to the 15 and 2 10 to the 15 centimeters. So it's a tenth smaller. And in this case, the configuration that is probably at the origin of this thing is a configuration in which the CSM is directly, or the CSM, is basically a circumstellar envelope associated with the progenitor. So like the material is embedded into, the star is embedded into some envelope. So some people have been arguing that these observations, for which you have interaction early on within 2 days, and then you have no signatures of interaction afterwards, could be the result of a superwind phase that you have immediately before core collapse. And one interpretation that we have, one alternative that you might invoke is that the presence of this material is just the normal structure that you get in red supergiant atmospheres, in the sense that these atmospheres, essentially, you do not drive a wind from the surface of the MESA model, or because the density is very high. The surface gravity is quite low, and so if you have some pulsations or some perturbation at the base or at the surface of the star, you can actually, you know, feed like a cocoon of material around your red supergiant star, and have material basically circulating on long time scales. And I've put a figure here for Betelgeuse, from taken from Kervela. There's lots more observations. This is the radius that you get at the near-infrared photosphere. And this is the amount of stuff that they see. In those papers, they report that some material, even a 10-hour star, is moving in. And so the idea that the wind would be initiated from here and would go steadily out, you know, following a prescribed velocity law, is just completely contradictory with the observations. Because there's no way you can get an inflow at 10-hour star if you are in the steady state outflow. And so what I'm wondering, and what we propose in this paper, is whether this material, which is optically thin when you look at it you know, in a red supergiant star, it's optically thin because electrons are completely recombined with hydrogen. So you know, the opacity, sources of opacity might be molecules and things like that, or H-alpha if you look at specific lines. But once you get shock breakout at this radius, you're going to ionize this material, and this material will be optically thick. And so in order to reproduce the observations for this object that is reported by Yaron, You know, if you want to have interaction with CSF for about 2 days, 2 days is basically 2×10⁴ centimeters. That's like 5 R star for your object. And this matches very well the observation. So this is compatible with the idea that you have a shot going through this atmosphere, which contains some mass, for like 2 days, and then it overruns this. And once it's overrun this this material, then it looks like a normal normal type 2.
But the total amount of mass in that material is very small.
Yeah, it's like 10⁻²⁰ sort of mass or something, and that's enough to have basically an optical depth of 10 or something like this. And the reason why you can make the thing optically thick is because it's much more compact than in the previous cases, where you have stretched your density structure out to 10⁵ centimeters or more.
But you can still get the narrow lines because...
And so we've done simulations for this, so that we've done simulations. So basically what I did is that I took a model initially from MESA, and then I did the explosion with V1D and whatever. And I take this structure just before shock breakout. So this structure is the shocked chair, and then this is the remaining surface that has not been shocked. And then I put different environments around this. This is in the log. So that's R star. For 15 solar mass model, this is a 15 solar mass model, but it has bigger radius, so you can ignore it. But the key point is that I'm basically polluting this environment, or I'm postulating the presence of a higher density in between R star, which is here, and 5×10⁴ centimeters. So in some of them, I just changed the scale height. Some of them, I just put different wind densities. When I say it's a wind, it does it. I have no constraint on the velocity. I'm just putting stuff in that region. And then I follow this the shock through these different models, and what I get is this huge diversity of Likers. That's again from Heracles with this radiation hydro. And so what you can see, so you ignore this one, which is from a bigger star, but what you can see for all the other ones, they are the same progenitor model from MESA, or the only difference is that they have different environments. And so when you look at the early time, you can see what a mess you can get. You can basically change completely the profile that you would get. This is a shock breakout if you had basically a low density wind. As soon as you start extending the atmosphere or adding mass in the environment, you can broaden this signal. And then we calculated lots of spectra. It's the same process as before. This is a case where you have a very low wind density, and this is a case where you have a large wind density, or a large density in the environment. And so to go back to the discussion on the line profile morphology that I talked about before, what you should be looking for here is, when do I see a Doppler broadened line, and when do I see an electron scattering broadened line? And so the associated feature with the Doppler broadened line is that it will be blue shifted. And so these are the indications of the lines that you see. This is nitrogen 4, and you can see there's a huge blue shift. And this one is associated with carbon 4, blue shifted. This one is 05. This is 06. They're all sitting to the blue of the rest wavelength for that corresponding line. That's the case where you have a low wind density. In the case of a high wind density, you can see that the lines are sitting at the rest wavelength. And the electron scattering problem, they're all symmetric. So you get O6, helium-2, and so on. And then you have this transition where you see, essentially, this is a rectified spectrum, which is why there's no change in color. You see basically very weak emission and basically purely absorption, and then you transition to something that looks more like a normal type 2. So this is 4 hours, and this is 15 days. And when you compare it to the observations, it's a bit the same. You have these line profiles early on, and then you have blue featureless, no absorption, and then you see like a normal type 2 plateau supernova.
But the models that you call high dense environment, amount of mass in that environment is no longer just a 1/10 of the solar mass, right? It's more.
No, well, so it depends. So the question is how you... So the amount of mass is given here. It goes to 0.1 solar mass. So it starts, it's around 10⁻³ up to 10⁻¹ solar mass. But the question is, so you know, when we talk about a configuration in which you have an ejecta ramming into detached CSM, you can talk about the mass of the CSM. Now, when you take a star and then you say there's a cocoon of material to that star, it's clearly, it's very loosely bound. Is it part of the star or is it part of CSM? It's not CSM, it's like an envelope.
Well, and you do have this model of well-defined boundary to the star.
Well, no, no, but this boundary is completely artificial.
It's a
numerical.
The model that you're doing, you have a factor of 100 different in the amount of mass that you put above that line, where you have the initial shot breakup. All I'm trying to say is that you have the transition to the from one kind of spectrum to the other when you have a lot of mass. But the other question is that what's supposed to be key about type 2 and supernova, or what the original topic, it was superluminous supernova. How much extra energy do you actually get out of doing this?
You get that. You basically double the amount of energy that you radiate. So it's like this one, for example. This is the same explosion, and it's just different environment. And so you get a very significant boost over that time. So I think it doubles.
For the most massive case.
Yeah. This is integrated L-ball DT over 15 days. And so you can crank it up to 2 × 10⁴, whereas like the basic ones is like 10⁴ or half that.
Right, but that's for the most massive case.
Double. Yeah, sure. But the problem is, so the question is, do you consider that? I mean, I would say this is, my model is this one, for example. This is the atmosphere of the star. So if we were doing these simulations with MESA, for example, and we had like molecular opacities, dust, and then we were really doing the physics of the wind, I would say the surface of my star is somewhere there. This is where I initiate the wind. Therefore, the total mass of my object is that thing.
What you might consider to be the surface would depend on what optical band you were looking at, what spectrum band you were looking at. That's a defined surface. I know. I'm just trying to say I understand that, but okay.
Now, there's a huge ambiguity with this because so when you do modeling of supernovae, you're sensitive to the mass.
Yeah.
People, there's like a huge community, stellar physics community, that looks at the upper 10⁻⁵ solar mass of material at the surface of stars, and they they fill up the HR diagram, with these objects. Yeah, what changes between many of these objects is just 10⁻⁵ solar mass. Okay, it doubles in radius. Oh, it changes color, and you can do lots of things. The bulk of the mass of the star doesn't do anything.
Inflation of stars is in somewhere.
Yeah, and so you can get stars to move across the HR diagram, but nothing happens in them. It's like a purely surface phenomenon. Now, supernovae, they tell you a lot about what happens in these very high density regions. And so they're far less sensitive to all these biases that people have when they observe stars, where you're completely dominated by uncertainty. And people who are studying Betelgeuse, if you look in H-alpha, if you look for dust, if you look for the near infrared, if you look in the optical, you get different models, different results. This is complete bias. And when you compare the radii from interferometry with the radii that we get from supernovae, we get smaller radii. We have smaller radii. The bulk of the mass, in our view, is that smaller radii. Yeah. And so I think this makes sense.
Okay, I think we should probably cut.
Yeah, and then I had my final one. So
that is
1 minute.
1 minute?
Yeah, it's 1 minute.
I want to hear it, that's for sure.
Anybody who wants to go?
Why don't we just clap and everybody
clap and
then
I'll listen. I'll sit here and listen.
Yeah, you can go.
Okay.
Okay, so what's very interesting with this object, so let me show you the observations again. The thing that is very surprising with this object, it was studied by Chugai, Blinnikov, and people with numerical hydrodynamics, really good radiation hydro, so a good physical model, and they produced something for this object that seemed very contradictory. And the contradiction or the complexity of this model is revealed by the evolution of these lines. If you recall 2010 JAR, initially it's narrow and then it broadens. It makes sense that it broadens because eventually you just see like the big monster that's coming from below. But this guy is narrow early on and it gets narrower, and this is classified as an interacting supernova. So how is that possible? And in the model of Chugai, what they did is that they took the model that I've just shown for 98S. They took a normal explosion and they put 0.4 solar mass around it. And they calculated the light curve, and the light curve matches. The light curve of 98S and the light curve of 94W are identical. It's the same light curve. But the spectra are completely different. So the model that we came up with, and Chugai actually has revised his model of 2004, and it has basically the same model as us. He published it like 1 month before us. basically the same time, is one in which the inner shell has very little mass. If you want to get narrow lines at late times, what you need to do is to reverse this momentum balance. You need to have the inner shell being light, have a lot of energy but being light, and the outer shell to be very massive, so that you go to a conversion efficiency of like 100%. The entire amount of energy that you have in the inner shell is going to be dumped into this outer shell. And so the way I produce the shells here is I did two eruptions in my, well, I took a red supergiant star, I triggered an explosion at the base of the hydrogen envelope, so I ejected the hydrogen envelope, it's a low energy explosion, and then I did a second explosion of the helium star that remains, which is, you know, similar to if you had like mass transfer or something and then you get rid of the hydrogen envelope. And so if you blow up that helium star, it's only two solar masses, or one solar mass, you know, it's the helium core. And so you have an ejector that is, in this case, the total mass was 0.3 solar mass. It's very small, but it has a pretty large kinetic energy. And the outer shell is very massive, six solar mass. And the kinetic energy is not very large either in this one. And so you can see that you're going to reverse the competition between the two shells. So when we do the simulation for this, it's the same plots as before. What you can see is that the very fast material, which is present early on, when you go 100 days, it's essentially completely gone, and it's just low-density material. And so what you end up doing in this model is that this inner shell has been completely decelerated by this outer shell. And so the reason why you don't see broad lines is because there's no fast material. After about 10 days, all this fast material has just disappeared. It's been completely braked. And so when we do the simulations for this, this is what we get for this model. And it looks really good. We have narrow lines, and we have even narrower lines at late times. And this is pretty much the same corresponding epochs for the slight shape. But the overall correspondence between the observations and the model.
Again, the velocity of that narrow component.
So the critical thing here is that the CSM that you run into is this pre-ejected hydrogen envelope. It is not CSM. This is called an interacting supernova, but it is not an interacting supernova. You're not interacting with the wind. What this is a revived, is a resurrected red supergiant explosion. You basically have a very low energy explosion, potentially, in a red supergiant star. You get rid of the hydrogen envelope. So perhaps it's caused by a neon flash or something like that.
But don't you see the progenitor wheel there?
No, this absorption. So you have an absorption here, which is very narrow. Perhaps I have it here, yeah? This is basically the absorption that you get. And we have it in the models and in the observations. This is the absorption that you get from just the slow-moving material in that shell. There's no wind here. It's just because the shell was ejected with a very low energy. And that's what you want. You want to have this big lump of material moving slowly and completely decelerating, this very fast material that has very little mass in the inner region.
Isn't it a bit of a coincidence that it also is at 100 kilometers per second, just in all the other ones?
Well, you take 10 solar mass of material, you eject it with 10 to the 49 ergs, and it will move at 300 kilometers per second, and you will just get down. You can tune
it.
Not
a few, it's 100. But anyway.
Yeah, it's all around there. It might be a numerical instrumental resolution as well. So what's very interesting about this object is that the reason why it has a completely different evolution in the spectra is because it's a reversed mass, you know, ejector mass, CSM mass, that you get in normal or superluminous events like 2010 JR. And I think what this is, the phenomenon that I like the most to explain such things is these nuclear flashes that you might get in some low mass massive stars. And some people say this is completely hypothetical analysis, yeah, but I think that what the observations are telling you here is that there are not many configurations that will allow you to reproduce these observations. You only see hydrogen lines, you never see oxygen, there's no signature of nickel, and the lines are getting narrower and narrower. So you need to produce a lot of energy into a shell that's like a 10 to the 15 centimeters, and how can you do that? You cannot inject energy from the outer parts.
So in any of these models or observations, can you distinguish whether then the underlying supernova has fast-moving ejector which contain hydrogen, or whether that's not the case?
So in most cases, what you're sensitive to is the dense shell, the composition of the dense shell, and the composition of the CSM. What's below in our 1D simulation, this is really hard to see. It's also that the inner ejecta is expanding. So the phase during which it could contribute to the radiation is completely swamped by the radiation that you inject at the shock. So it's completely invisible. The thing is that the dense shell is unstable, and so it should break up. So you might get a lot of chemical mixing at the level of the dense shell, which would bring material from the ejecta in the region where you radiate. So
if there was... You say there's a helium star exploding, then this is really speculation. There's no... You cannot distinguish that from...
No, the reason why I say... No, yeah, so...
Low mass, that's why. The reason you need helium was low mass, right?
Yeah, low mass of hydrogen.
Oh, it could be another, yeah, so but if it's a red supergiant star, okay, if it's a red supergiant star and you trigger a nuclear flash, it will not be in a hydrogen envelope, it will come from the core. You're going, because it's so loosely bound, you will lose the entire hydrogen envelope. So once this happens, there's no hydrogen.
That's based on your hypothesis, not based on data. I'm just wondering what we can deduce from the data.
So, I mean, it could be a blue supergiant as well, and perhaps you can have multiple shells with hydrogen. But, you know, here what you want is really a very different mass ratio between inner shell and outer shell. And so the thing that is nice about this is that if you consider a red supergiant star, then you lose the hydrogen envelope. That's the large lump of mass. And then it's a low mass helium core, 2-3 solar mass helium core, and you're not going to have an ejecta more massive than one solar mass, something like that. And so And if you have a neon flash, what I like about it is that you have a natural clock. Because this will happen like a few years before core collapse. So you know the outer shell won't have run to the outer side of the universe, you know, before your core collapse. And so I think this is a very it's a very attractive thing. You only need to basically postulate one phenomenon, and then the whole thing can be explained. Now, people who do evolution of low-mass stars, they have great difficulties going to core collapse because they keep having those flashes. And perhaps this is telling you something.
Sure, I've seen a model where this such flashes explode then of stars.
Absolutely, but it's, you know, who's done it, multi-D, and I don't know.
So maybe the lesson here is that if you pre-supernova deposition of energy in a star that's relatively well-bound leads to maybe a prolonged mass loss rate that's near the energy limit. But such an event going off in a red supergiant, which is very loosely bound, it just ejects that hydrogen envelope as a kind of a impulsive thing.
If it's deposited deep, the whole star is
obviously
affected.
Obviously deposited deep in the both cases.
Yeah, in red supergiant stars, it's not you're not in a favorable configuration to have something very unstable being sort of in quasi-steady state to drive a flow over a long time. I would expect that if you inject energy even at a low rate in a red supergiant envelope, it would just expand a lot. I mean, the whole thing would just be unstable. So you're not gonna. What you need to have these super Newton winds, you really need something that is like a fixed base and from which you blow stuff.
Okay. So, I think we're done.
No.
Okay. So you have to catch a loop today if you have more questions.